You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudet. Idaho has confirmed its first pediatric death due to COVID-19. In a news release yesterday, Idaho Department of Health and Welfare said the child was an infant younger than 1 year old who lived in Southwest Idaho. The baby died in October. Nationwide, nearly 900 children have died from COVID-19. And even though this is our state's first recorded death in a child due to COVID, there have been adverse outcomes for children other than death. Here in Idaho, Idaho has reported so far 37 cases of COVID-related multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children. This is a painful inflammation involving multiple organs in pediatric patients. Joining us today to talk more about this, as well as everything else COVID-related, are Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, as well as Dr. Megan McInerney, St. Alphonsus ICU Medical Director. I want to thank both of you for joining us today.
Thank you, Gemma.
Thanks, Gemma.
And remember, if you have questions for our medical experts, get them into us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Dr. Pate, this is a statistic that I think we were all hoping to have to avoid. At the same time, knowing when we look at the rate of vaccination in the state of Idaho, that this was inevitable.
Yeah, Gemma, it has been. It's something that we've certainly feared, but knew that the odds were against us, especially if we can't get more Idahoans vaccinated, because the way we protect children, particularly small children who can't be vaccinated, is by making sure that we get everybody vaccinated around them. And we just don't have high enough vaccination rates. So unfortunately, it's unlikely this will be the last either. And it's such a tragedy when we don't protect children.
Dr. McInerney, you've been on the program before. You have young children. This has to hit close to home as well, seeing what you see in the ICU.
Yes, it does. It's tragic, actually. And none of us know a lot about the case, and rightfully so. That family, you know, deserves privacy. And my condolences go out to them for sure. But just like Dr. Pate said, it's our job as adults and community members and all of those of us who can be vaccinated to get vaccinated so that we protect infants and others who are unable to get the vaccine. And, you know, that's the case not only with COVID, but all vaccinations, right? I remember when my babies were first born, the rule was to come and visit our house. You have to be vaccinated for influenza, you know, and so it's consistent with all infectious diseases for which we have vaccines to protect the community. You know, that we need to vaccinate those who are able to get vaccinated so that we protect those who cannot.
And with that being said, Dr. McInerney, some news coming out last week, 5 to 11 year olds finally being able to be vaccinated. What is the response been? What have you seen at St. Alphonsus? I mean, I must say, I got my 9-year-old in as soon as possible, and he got that first shot last Thursday.
Well, I can't, you know, I'm not a pediatrician, so I don't take care of kiddos. And so I'm not at the front line per se of vaccinating children. I do know that St. Alphonsus has a robust vaccination program for children. We have 3 different sites where kids can get vaccinated. And so there's been a good amount of vaccines being delivered. So I can't speak directly to, you know, what it's looking like for people coming in. I know that, you know, the majority of my partners, all of the partners that I've been able to talk to who are critical care docs are getting their kids vaccinated. My children were fortunate enough to be in the vaccine trial. So, you know, when the vaccine trial was unblinded, once the vaccine was approved, we found out that one of my sons had gotten the actual vaccine and the other got the placebo. So as soon as we could, we got the you know, kid who had gotten the placebo in to get the actual vaccine. So I think it's exciting times. And many, many parents who understand the importance of getting their kids vaccinated are jumping on, you know, and getting their kids vaccinated as soon as possible.
Yeah. Dr. Payne, another thing that has made huge headlines in the last few days has to deal with the Green Bay Packers football team. Never thought I would talk about football when we talk about medicine. With that being said, quarterback Aaron Rodgers, back at the beginning of the season, for folks who have maybe not been paying attention to this, during a news conference with media, said that he was immunized, making, I think, the general public to believe that he had been vaccinated. Can we talk about the semantics of this, Dr. Pate? Because, you know, I bring this up because there is such an issue. People have said, you know, well, Aaron Rodgers lied, you know, this and that. I mean, he's come out and said he wasn't vaccinated. He said he was, quote, following all the rules, but a couple of them. With that said, you can make the argument that he potentially put so many people in harm's way for the actions that he chose, but also by using the word immunized.
Yes. Well, you're right. You know, that was I think probably a very carefully chosen word to help him feel as though perhaps he's not outright lying. But in fact, there is little distinction between immunized and vaccinated. Vaccinated means that you have received the vaccine. Immunized means you either have immunity because you've received the vaccine or because you've been infected. And I don't think either of those two things were true based on what we know about Aaron Rodgers' situation. And you're exactly right when you mislead people. And, you know, this is the day and time of misinformation and disinformation. I hope that we can get back to being honest with people, because being misleading, and I think he knew that, he was putting people at risk. You know, what I've heard him say is that he got some kind of homeopathic remedy to increase his antibodies. Well, you know, I'm going to try to be a little bit charitable and assume that he saw some homeopathic provider who did mislead him, that would give some kind of protection, because raising your antibodies doesn't give you any protection. It only protects you when you have antibodies against COVID, which are the SARS virus, which you're not going to have unless you get the vaccine or infection. So, you know, it's really unfortunate that he was not truthful. He was not forthcoming. Because of that, he endangered people. And then, of course, since that's happened, you know, he's been now trying to blame this on everybody else, which we see as a common strategy when someone makes a mistake. Don't admit that you made a mistake. Try to blame it on everybody else, including if you're a white male multimillionaire, talk about how oppressed you are and call on Martin Luther King, which is just about as absurd as the initial misrepresentation.
Yeah. There's a difference between cancel culture and consequence culture. Dr. McInerney, I'm curious to know how things are going at St. Alphonsus. We know that the case numbers are going down. Do you think there will be an easing up of crisis of standards of care soon?
The admission numbers for patients with COVID have decreased at St. Alphonsus and at St. Luke's Hospital. And as a statewide, you know, healthcare community, we continue to watch our numbers up in Kootenai and in Northern Idaho, which are still struggling a fair amount. So I would say that, yes, the numbers are coming down. We still need to watch the numbers very closely, and we're not out of the woods by any means, because we are entering into the holiday season, where a lot of people will be taking their masks off, putting their guards down, gathering in large groups, and I suspect that our numbers will go back up. As far as crisis standards of care, this is going to be determined at the statewide level. Our crisis standards of care were initiated not only because of the number of COVID patients that we were seeing, but also because of the lack of the stressed resources, I should say, that we've had. Mm-hmm. And so we still are stressed with our resources. I think that we probably, the state might be able to let up in time, maybe over the next couple of weeks to months. But I do worry about the holiday season. And I think it's important to note that even if the statewide crisis standards of care is in place, you know, individual hospitals have also had to declare crisis standards of care. So even if the statewide crisis standards of care is still in place, hospitals can also say, no, we're no longer needing to staff at the bedside with, you know, a different patient to nurse ratio. We are able to staff in normal ratios. So individual hospitals will be able to lift that sooner than the statewide. I hope that answers that question.
It does. And I do want to touch on another thing. You've said you're concerned about the upcoming holiday season. We're also heading into cold and flu season. Mm-hmm. Have you seen any flu cases yet? And also, how concerned are you about how that will then impact the pandemic?
We have not at St. Alphonsus seen any admissions for influenza. And I suspect that the numbers of influenza cases will increase as the winter months come on, as will the number of COVID cases, because it's a respiratory virus and the transmission will occur in settings where people are not wearing masks, are indoors and in close quarters. So I suspect that they will increase because people have largely started returning to their normal behavior. Last year, we didn't have much of a flu season because people were masked, social distancing, and a lot of places were closed down for large gatherings. That's going to be very, very different this year, right? There's indoor sporting events happening. People are gathering in large groups for holidays. So I suspect that the influenza season will be much more significant this year than it was last year.
Dr. Pate, before we get into the listener questions, I do want to go back to what we touched on at the top of the program today, and that was the pediatric death that happened here in Idaho. But I want to talk more specifically about other adverse events outside of death. We have talked about this before in adults in particular, but as I mentioned, so far in Idaho, there have been 37 cases of this pediatric multi-system inflammatory syndrome. And we also know that kids are getting long COVID. So again, it is so easy to focus on, well, there was only one death of a child. Let's be clear, though, there shouldn't be any deaths of children.
Amen. You're exactly right. Most children are going to survive COVID. We don't have a way to know that ahead of time, which ones are going to survive, which ones aren't. Also, as you pointed out, frankly, for children, our biggest concern is not them dying, but them having the complications or sequela of infection. One of the most serious, you've already mentioned, MISC, or the multi-inflammatory system, or multi-system inflammatory syndrome that we see in children. And that is, those children are most often critically ill. And certainly that is life-threatening. And it is a system in which it involves multiple organ systems of their body. And so while so far it appears that those children that survive do recover, we don't have a lot of long-term studies yet because of how new this pandemic is. You also mentioned long COVID. We first realized that occurred in adults, but sadly, we discovered it also happens in children, although thank God it appears to be a lower rate than adults. We've talked before about myocarditis. We've also talked about there have been some reports out of Europe of children developing diabetes after COVID. So we're going to have to follow that because we do know that the virus attacks cells within the pancreas. There's been some very concerning data coming out that I don't think is conclusory yet. We need more studies and longer term studies, but showing that there is cognitive and intellectual impairment after COVID. Even in adults, they can have a significant loss of IQ after infection. So I think the point that you're making, Gemma, is that number one, there is this multitude of complications and long-term effects that can occur. And number two, that we don't really understand all that yet. And how long do they last? Do all these children eventually recover? What is going to be the long-term effect? And when we don't know, I think the best thing is let's protect our children. And there are, you know, so many people spreading misinformation. I do fear that a lot of parents are going to avoid getting their children vaccinated. That would be a shame because it is safe and effective. And I'll tell you, lately, I've been dealing with some single mothers, one with three children, one with four children, who have become severely ill with COVID. And we were having to dash around and make plans for how were these children going to be cared for if they had to go in the hospital or worse, if they died. And so even if the children aren't directly affected, we have more than 500 Idaho children who have lost their primary caregiver due to COVID. So it's this is a significant concern.
And just from my perspective as a parent, because people knowing that my children are vaccinated have reached out to ask how they are doing, how they reacted to it. My 13-year-old was vaccinated back in May. 12 hours after his first shot, he complained of being a little cold. That is a sign in our family that he doesn't feel well because he never gets cold. He had a slight fever. He went to bed, woke up 6 hours later. He was perfectly fine. His intellectual capacity has not been impacted. He has all A's and B's. He probably doesn't want me to tell people that, but he is fine. My 9-year-old got his first COVID vaccine last Thursday. This child didn't miss a beat. It would have been nice if he'd felt a little under the weather because he's like having a border collie. he is perfectly fine. He is doing perfectly well. So if you have concern as a parent, most children are doing fine after they are vaccinated and life moves on. With that said, I want to get to some listener emails. And Dr. McInerney, Cindy wrote in and she says, my husband received the J&J vaccine in July. I think he should get a Pfizer booster instead of going for another J&J. He's 70 years old with some underlying health issues. What do you think about mixing vaccinations?
So the mixing of vaccinations is somewhat of a recent conversation that came up this summer. And I'm really appreciative that people have started looking at this. There was a study released in the NIH initially on June 1st, I think, 2021. And so the idea of mixing, just so that the listeners know, is that the primary vaccine that's given, and in this case, it's the J&J, but even if it was the Pfizer or the Moderna, meaning the first round of vaccines, that a booster could be any of the other three. And so the CDC supports this idea and says it is okay, and in some cases might even be a benefit, but they say across the board, all of the vaccines work well. And if there's concerns about being able to get access to the J&J or access to the Moderna, then you can mix and match those vaccines for your booster. I will say that the J&J vaccination has recommended that the booster could be given within 2 months after the initial primary vaccine is given for J&J. So if that person got the J&J, they can get another J&J vaccine, you know, as early as 2 months later. But as far as mixing, I think it really depends on the person. It depends on what they have access to. I, you know, in my personal life, my parents had also gotten the J&J vaccine, and then they got the Moderna booster. And that was more about availability. But I think you're going to be okay. The booster is a good idea, no matter how you cut it. It's going to improve immunity and decrease the likelihood of getting severe disease and dying from COVID.
Dr. Pate, Jen and Eagle just wrote in, and she says, my son turned 12 a few weeks ago. He's small for his age, and he is underweight. Can he receive the pediatric dose of the COVID-19 vaccine? And if not, what is significant about age 12 in terms of needing the adult dose of the vaccine?
Yeah, well, there's nothing magical about being 11 years old and 355 days old versus 12 years old. But there is a difference between younger children and older children in terms of their immune systems. So it happens to be that the studies grouped children by age groups. And so that is what the FDA has evaluated, and they've set out the criteria based on age. Generally, body weight is not going to be a significant factor in the vaccine selection. If she is particularly concerned, I certainly encourage her to talk to her child's pediatrician, and perhaps if there is some very significant developmental issue that has caused the child to be underweight, that might alter the choice. But generally, you should get the vaccine according to the age group.
Dr. McInerney, Scott wrote in, his dad was diagnosed with COVID 3 weeks ago. He is recovering. He's mildly symptomatic. So Scott has this question because his dad had heard that he should wait 90 days to get the booster shot. One doctor told him that. He said another doctor told him to wait until he's symptom free. So he would like to know, he says there seems to be a difference of opinion on what he should do. So could you potentially clear that up?
Sure. I think the confusion currently comes with, no, I've heard this confusion a lot. Currently, the recommendations are that you can get the COVID vaccination once you've been removed from isolation, which for most patients who do not, who are not immune compromised or have not been admitted into the intensive care unit, that removal from isolation is 10 days. It's probably a good idea to wait until his symptoms have essentially resolved. But he doesn't need to wait the 90 days. The 90 days waiting period is only for people who have had COVID and received monoclonal antibodies. Mm. So there's some evidence that shows that getting something called a monoclonal antibody early in the disease helps to prevent people from progressing to severe disease. If someone received a monoclonal antibody in the early phases of their COVID illness and they get vaccinated before those 90 days pass, the vaccine won't work as well because the monoclonal antibodies are basically going to target or to prevent the vaccine from taking effect. So that's, I think, where the confusion came from. So if his father did not receive monoclonal antibody and his symptoms are improved and he's greater than 10 days from the onset of symptoms, I think it's okay for him to go ahead and get vaccinated. And like Dr. Pate also said about your previous caller, it's also good to check with his physician.
Right. But good information, because there is, I mean, sometimes it can be really confusing. We are getting so many questions in about social gatherings. I think a lot of this has to do with the upcoming holidays. with people gathering, people wanting to know if it's safe to socially gather, if you're vaccinated, should it be indoors, outdoors, should you wear masks, should you not? With that said, Dr. Pate, Helen just wrote in and she said, I attended a BSU men's basketball game at Extra Mile Arena and there were few masks. So is it safe to attend games? So maybe if you could give your thoughts on that, but then also, I mean, just so many questions coming in about social gatherings.
Yeah. Well, these are good questions. So let me kind of give you, your listeners, a framework. So the first question is, we have to understand, what are we saying when we're asking, when people are asking, is it safe? There are some people that are at very high risk and they want to know that they have negligible or zero risk. There are other people who have certainly taken some steps to protect themselves and they're willing to take some risk. So we have to understand that what's safe to me might be different than what you would consider to be safe. But in general, we have to look at kind of both sides of the equation, if you will. So the risk is, first of all, what have you done? So are you fully vaccinated? And if you qualify, you're eligible for a booster, have you gotten your booster? If you've done those things, you've done most of what you can to put yourself in the best position. Then we have to look at the other side. Are the people that you're going to be around done the same thing? So it's quite a different matter if Dr. McInerney and I were to get together for coffee because we're both fully vaccinated versus I go to one of those games at the arena where, of course, if you just apply our Idaho statistics, you probably got half of those people are vaccinated. So that's going to be a risky situation. Then when you look at situations in which the people are getting together, you have to ask, how much separation are we going to have? Obviously, if you're in a crowded theater, game event, whatever, and you're standing shoulder to shoulder with people, you're going to be at risk. And the other question is it indoors or outdoors? You can still get infected outdoors if you're close enough, but it is going to be less likely. And if you can get some distance outside, then you don't have to wear a mask. On the other hand, if you're going to be close together outside, we've certainly had lots of transmissions at weddings, at concerts, those kind of things. If you're going to be outside, but you're going to be close together, you still need to wear a mask. The most dangerous situation is to be indoors with people that you do not know are vaccinated or you know some of them are not. That is going to be the most dangerous situation.
And Dr. Pate, I should note, and I think I am correct on this, I just looked it up, that I believe at the basketball games, there is no, you don't need to have proof of a vaccination or a negative COVID test. What about in situations where you are in it and like an arena setting where you cannot enter unless you have proof of vaccination or you have to have a negative COVID test? And if you are not, even if you are not vaccinated and you have that negative COVID test, you have to wear a mask. Does that change the dynamic of these indoor settings?
Well, it does. You look to certain cities that have implemented vaccine requirements. Have to show your proof of vaccination to get in. Certainly, we have seen so far that it appears to work well, even indoors. Now, so that's the best situation. If you know everyone indoors is vaccinated. The next best is the two. And the problem why testing is not as good is it depends what's the test done and what kinds of risks has the person had in that meantime. So let's take, for example, there's a requirement to return to the United States on a flight that you have to be tested 3 days prior to coming back. If you're engaged in risky behavior, 3 days is plenty of time for you to get infected and get to the point where you could infect others. So I'm not going to have the degree of comfort about someone testing negative 3 days ago as I am if somebody got tested this morning and was negative. Mm. The tests aren't fail-proof either. So I think that yes, if you're going to an indoor setting and you're going to be around people, I choose not to do that very much. If I'm going to do it, I would feel the most comfortable if everybody was vaccinated. I'd feel next most comfortable if people were vaccinated and had a negative test. But if that was going to be the case, I'd be wearing my mask indoors.
Yeah. Dr. McInerney, Carol wrote in. She said that her husband had a breakthrough case of COVID a month ago. He did get the monoclonal treatment 4 days into COVID. She says he is now concerned about traveling because he cannot get his booster for another 2 months. So she's wanting to know, are the antibodies he received protective enough to fly wearing a mask? Now, with that said, I also think, Dr. McInerney, this goes back to this idea of what people's safety, you know, how they determine what safe or what risk is. But you had also mentioned the monoclonal treatment a little bit ago.
So I am not aware of, and I don't know if Dr. Pate can speak to this, of any studies that have looked at preventing recurrent infections after administration of monoclonal antibodies. We do know that in general, the combination of having been vaccinated plus getting infected is the best combination for having immunity for future infections. So all of that to say, you're right, Gemma, it goes back to this person's risk tolerance. I think that the risk for him is certainly lower, given that he's had the primary series of the vaccines plus a recent infection. His risk of getting an infection now is lower than those people who have either only gotten the vaccination or only been infected or have neither gotten the vaccination or infected in the past. My recommendation, I would just say my personal practice, if I had to go on an airplane, would be to double mask, meaning to wear a surgical mask with a cloth mask on top or a K95 or an N95 on the flight and just be very cautious if they have to fly. But the risk is lower than I think many others. Dr. Pate, I don't know if you're aware of any studies that look at rates of infection after receiving monoclonal antibodies within those 3 months after.
No, I haven't seen any of those studies either, Dr. McInerney, and I agree with everything you said. We know that the monoclonal antibodies are degraded by your body pretty promptly. So I certainly wouldn't be counting on monoclonal antibodies, but I think, as you said, really the infection is the equivalent of getting the booster. That person should still get boosted at some time during the road, but they probably have fairly good protection, not because of the monoclonal antibodies, but because of their previous vaccination and then the infection, just as you said.
I want to get to a question from Nancy, and frankly, would like both of your thoughts on this. It's a little bit long, but I think it's important to read the whole thing. So Nancy says, my daughter is vaccinated and due to deliver her child this month. Her husband's parents live out of state. They are planning air travel to Boise shortly after the birth to meet their grandchild. They are not vaccinated against COVID. What is her child's likely level of immunity conferred by having received the vaccine in utero? What standards of protection would you advise she take during their visit? And maybe Dr. Pate, I can start with you.
Sure. Well, this is a really difficult one. And I think it's really challenging because I think the parents are going to have to make some very tough decisions and uncomfortable ones. I think husband and wife, the soon-to-be, need to have a conversation about where do they draw the line. You heard Dr. McInerney say earlier that, you know, if you were going to come over to her house and be around her kids, you better have had your flu shot. I think the primary role of parents is to protect their children, particularly children that are so young cannot protect themselves. So the criteria I would use is what is best for our baby. And frankly, it's not good for the baby to be around anybody who's unvaccinated. And so this is going to be tough. I can imagine if I had to have the conversation with my parents, but I would, that, you know what, we would love for you to see our new baby, your new grandchild. And as soon as you're fully vaccinated, please come. We want you to see your grandchild. In the meantime, we'll FaceTime. You can, we'll send you pictures, that kind of thing. But that's going to be a pretty uncomfortable conversation. So if they're not willing to do that, and that set of parents is going to come to Boise, then you have to understand they're not vaccinated. It sounds like they're not taking very many precautions. And you just heard Dr. McInerney say, and I totally agree, about the precautions that she and I would take if we were on a flight, because we have well-documented transmissions of disease on a flight. Again, that's going to be the situation where you're going to be on a plane with a bunch of people that you don't know their vaccination status. So, the question is, if they're not willing to get vaccinated and they're not taking precautions, are they going to wear, are they going to double mask or wear a high quality mask on the airplane? If not, they're going to have some significant risk. We have to appreciate what the amount of disease transmission is in this state and in many states of the country. Yes, things are better, but it's quite high. And the chances that those parents will have been exposed to COVID is not insignificant. So now, on the question about the what degree of protection the baby has, first mm-hmm. of all, kudos to the mom for getting vaccinated. Yes, the baby will get some of those antibodies. We do know that those pass to the baby and the baby will have them. What we don't know for sure is how protective and how long. It does seem to be very protective, but generally antibodies pass from a mother to the baby last less than 3 months. We do know that mothers can give their babies even more protection if they have the antibodies and they're willing to breastfeed the baby. So that would be the other thing that they can do to protect that baby.
Mm-hmm. Dr. McInerney, this brings up just so many tough conversations that families are having all over the country. If these grandparents do visit, what about wearing, masks? Is that something that maybe they should think about doing within the home?
First of all, I agree with everything that Dr. Pate said, and also agree that this is all so hard. And as I was listening to Dr. Pate talk about laying out, some rules really for your own family, I guess that's the one, just from a mom to a mom piece of advice that I would give is that this is the beginning of a long period of time where you get to set the rules for what happens around your children. And to just acknowledge that that's your right to say, this is what I need to do to keep my kids safe. Yes, of course, wearing masks in the home would decrease the risk, but I still think that given the risk of traveling, the lack of vaccination, I personally would still strongly recommend that they be vaccinated. You know, because it'll be long periods of time. It'll be hard for most people to keep a mask on while staying in a home and every time they're interacting with somebody. You know, how often do we see people who drop their masks underneath their nose? And, you know, so it will decrease the risk, but it would have to be really closely monitored, for lack of a better word. This is very hard. And I, like I said, I go back to what Dr. Pate said, is that our job as parents is to keep our child safe. And you have the permission and the support to be able to say, we'd love to have you visit. And this is what we, these are the rules of our home for you to visit.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, it really is. You know, I have a sister who had a baby 5 months ago, and we have some siblings who are not vaccinated. And, you know, she has had to make, she's had to have difficult conversations, but you're not vaccinated. You can't be around the baby. And, you know, we're even waiting for her to come visit because the numbers, our positive case numbers are high in Idaho, and my youngest is not fully vaccinated yet. So we've had to make difficult choices, but you know, there's a 5-month-old baby who cannot be vaccinated. So it is some tough, tough conversations that unfortunately I think so many families have had to have. Very quickly, we only have about 2 minutes left, and I want to get to one more question. I thought this was interesting. And Petra asked, do we know, has there been any research done on breakthrough cases happening 6 months after vaccination? And Dr. Pate, do we have any information about that?
Oh, yes. We have lots of information, and that led to the FDA's decision to approve boosters. They looked at is the waning effect of the various vaccines, and that led to the recommendations that you heard Dr. McInerney state that for Johnson & Johnson, actually the booster should be anytime 2 months or after the primary shot. And then for the Pfizer, the mRNA vaccines, it should be if you've had it more than 6 months. And of course, there's some fine distinctions that we don't have time to go into. But yes, that is the reason for the boosters, is that there is some waning immunity and you could be a little bit more at risk for a breakthrough infection.
Well, as always, I want to thank both of you for answering our listener questions, for your wisdom, for telling us the facts, because we are still dealing with misinformation and disinformation, as you pointed out, Dr. Pate. So many thanks to Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, and Dr. Megan McInerney, St. Alphonsus ICU Medical Director. I really appreciate both of you so very much.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Jim. And thanks, Dr. McInerney.
Likewise, Dr. Pate. Thank you.
And remember, our medical experts will be back with us next week. So if you have a question, email us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Big thank you to all of our listeners. Thank you for sending in your questions. We appreciate all of you so much. Our producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Wednesday. I hope you have a good rest of your day, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.